one last point that I want to mention in connection with the third chapter. He says that after resurrection and the soul is united with the body, and the soul can purify the body, spiritualize the body, and soon they become harmonious in their appreciation of the spiritual. He then says each person will be given a position according to his effort in this world and what he earned. But that position is not static. After he's put at his initial position in the world to come, the body and the soul together will rise, continue to rise, according to whatever progress is appropriate to the level that he started at. Now, there's a little subtlety here. Rabbi Kaplan translates, will still be able to elevate himself. Page 59. That makes it sound like he's still making an effort, and he's got to push himself up. But in the Hebrew, it says, Yis'alu shnehem iluyim. Yis'alu, I think, should be understood passively. They will rise to new heights, elevations. But not that they are striving. There's no striving in the world to come. Now, someplace, I forget where, because I have a memory like a sieve, somewhere he says that the condition of the person in Olam Havoah, the world to come, cannot be static. Because if it would be static, it would become boring. Look how it is in this world. Take the most pleasant experience, any great pleasant experience, if you would have that experience continuously without stop, after a while you become dull to it, you become desensitized to it. You can't appreciate it anymore. That's why a very important element in a happy life is variety. You might like that picture, but you sit there and stare at the picture for an hour. You've had it already. That's it. Why don't you go off and do something else? You may be very enamored of vanilla ice cream, but how much vanilla ice cream can you eat after which time? You know, you get bored with it. So he says,
just a little fragment. That was certainly not nice. Unless it's something dropped from above.
Okay.
Shut the window. Well, we did it. Well, shutting the window could make it worse, right? This is a piece of glass.
I think it was a brick.
Yeah, well, here's a piece of it. It's
one of the
Jews of Sun. Maybe just go off the wall.
That can't be good.
Oh, well, it's better than some of the alternatives. Huh?
So he says, just as in this world, if what you're doing is constant, no matter how pleasant it might be, it's going to become boring. So in the next world also, if it would be just one static position, no matter how pleasant it could be, enjoying God's presence or whatever it is, you would lose your sensitivity, you become dull to it. And therefore, the world to come has to be understood as constant progress. Now, what I find striking here is bringing a proof about the nature of the world to come from this world. You know, I would have been just as happy if you would have said, yes, in this world you do get bored because you have a finite capacity to absorb the pleasure. But there, you know, it just goes on and on. There's some hidden principle here, something like, the nature of the person, the fundamental nature of the person doesn't change. Something like that. The fundamental nature of the person doesn't change, and therefore you can learn something from the experience of the person in this world about what the quality of the experience of a person in the next world must be. Just see something about that. Yeah, not to mention it. The Chofetz Chaim, beginning of Shmiras HaLashon, says,
started doing this
regularly with my wife. I was doing it for 3 nights, but this is... Say it like this. There are verses that say that a person who misuses his mouth, especially through Lashon Hara, he's destroying himself. Who is the man who desires life? Let him guard his tongue. Life. Not wealth and not happiness and not security, but life, the whole of life. And he who guards his tongue guards his soul from travail, from pain, from suffering. So he says, why is the tongue and the mouth so important? Why is Lashon Hara so important? So he says, in halacha, a deaf mute who has no means of communicating, which means it probably doesn't apply today, but there were times when a deaf mute could not communicate. He couldn't hear you talking to him, he couldn't speak back, and there wasn't an organized sign language. He's regarded as a person without mental competence. No mitzvos. If A injures B in such a way as to cause him to become a deaf mute, A has to pay B his total value. Because it's as if, as a functional person, he ceased to exist. Now, Chabad Chaim says, if you perform a transgression which damages your mouth and your ears, then spiritually you're putting yourself in a position of a deaf mute. And since in this world a deaf mute is counted as a non-functional person, so those spiritual capacities which the mouth and the ears represent, if they are injured, are going to deprive a person of his capacity to be functional in the next world. Just hit me as I'm speaking to you that he's saying exactly the same thing. Somehow, the characteristic of the person and his condition in this world tells you what the corresponding condition will be in the next world. Now, the Chafetz Chaim, when he wrote Shmiras Halashon, he wrote it specifically on the basis of the Zohar, among other sources. And Lutzato, as I told you, is a Kabbalist. So there's got to be something in the Zohar or related literature which relates to this. But I have not come across it. I just saw it in him and I fell off my chair. What kind of proof is that? In this world, the next world? But that, there has to be something common there. I'm just mentioning it to you as a matter of interest. Yeah.
If we say that the reason it has to be static, that it can't be static, is because we're going to get bored of it, then that's because, I guess, we have a concept of time here, but that would mean that there's also a concept of time in all of us.
Well, time really is just a measure of regular change. That's all it is. So if things are changing, time will be automatic.
Right, but things don't have to change if there's no...
Oh, I see what you mean. The boredom itself requires time. Boredom itself requires time. So then the... I think you're right. I think the word boredom here will have to be taken not exact, not literal, not based on the same dynamics as we have here. That's an interesting question, how time is measured under those conditions. All you have to have is something going on, right? Some of the pictures we have, like there's a shear going on, and you're sitting there, Moses is giving the shear, and you're sitting there learning Torah from him, right? So you're gaining new insights into how God's chesed work. There are pictures of activities taking place, and as long as there's change, any kind of change, then that's already a measure of time.
I'd always understood, like, kind of like how God, like, time does not exactly apply to God, because he's kind of outside, so I thought once we get to that stage, once we're really not human anymore, it's just the soul, so we're ready.
I think that's a little too narrow. Time is an aspect of change.
Right. But
so if anything's changing, If anything's changing, time will be there automatically.
We can still say that God is not limited by time.
But now, it's not a question of being part of the physical world. All you need is change. Imagine a non-physical spirit which is experiencing things, and experiencing one after the other, so it will be earlier and later. All you need is change. Change the content of its experience. So God's outside of time doesn't mean just that he's not physical. It means that in his essence, he's beyond all change.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. But by creating the world, is he... I just thought maybe he's like now working within time, at least with us, because...
Okay, this is a tricky thing. I'll tell you a little bit, but I don't want to go into this in too much detail. It's a tricky thing. If you say that God is outside of time... Okay, I have a friend who teaches Israelis, tries to be cured with Israelis, and he uses some of my material. He's in touch with me from quite regularly to explain things, to give proofs of things. And someone said to him recently, outside of time? That's absurd. That makes no sense at all. Yeah, that's Israeli. He doesn't ask a question. Please, sir, how would you explain it? No, it just makes no sense at all. It's ridiculous. So I said to him, first of all, ask him, you know, what time is the number six? We've been through that. Numbers aren't inside time. Right? Numbers aren't part of time. Because numbers don't change. The number six is what it is, it stays what it is, nothing happens to it. So it's not part of time. So the idea of something being outside of time in philosophy is trivial. Nobody disputes that. Now, so why couldn't God have that time? So I said, however, the real question might be, okay, let God be outside of time, but how do you explain his doing things in time? He can be outside of time, but how is he going to be the cause of events that take place in time? Now, the easy way out is to say that God, you're all sitting there? God is both inside and outside time. Ha! Okay, on to the next subject. All right, explain that. What do you mean? The Jewish sources say that God is both immanent, filling all of the creation and transcending the creation. Just as a kind of motto, where other philosophies say either or, the Torah typically says both. It sounds like either or because it sounds like a contradiction. Too bad. The Torah says both anyway. Now, there are religions which place God beyond the creation. And there are religions like pantheism which place godliness inside the creation. Judaism clearly said, cheerfully said both. God's being fills the whole of the creation, but is not exhausted thereby. There's more to God than the godliness in the world. God's essence, so to speak, transcends the whole of the creation, but he also fills the whole of the creation. That is called panentheism. Not pantheism, but panentheism. That's the technical term. So now, if you ask, how could God act in time? If he fills all the time, that's not a big deal. It's not such a difficult thing. So that's the easy way out. But as a matter of fact, philosophers of religion do write about a God who totally transcends time. He's totally outside of time, causing events in time. And although it may sound funny, no one has ever come up with any explicit contradiction, any explicit problem. Why can't there be a relationship between events in time with something that's outside of time? The events are in time, they're dated. So if you want, you could say the relationship is dated because this leg over here, inside time, is dated. But the other leg is outside of time. To develop an explicit contradiction in that is something which no one has ever done. So, could even just throw the ball back to the guy's court and say, look, you think this is a contradiction? Show me what the contradiction is. What's the problem? Why must both elements be in time? Yeah.
Is that sort of like how Rebbe says, like numbers are out of time. So applying numbers is a way of taking things that are out of time and putting them in time for that moment, but it still doesn't make sense.
That's a nice thought. I thought of it too, but I left it out because we're talking now specifically about causation. The problem will be, how can something outside of time cause an effect in time? Numbers don't cause anything in time. We use numbers to describe things that are in time. That's a much more abstract relationship. Nobody knows what that relationship is either, but it doesn't have the same punch that, you know, we should bring the number into time. Causation, the normal thought is, A causes B, A must be an event that occurred before B and brought B about. That's the normal thought, but no one has ever been able to demonstrate that it's got to be that way. Why can something outside of time bring into effect all sorts of things in time?
Yeah. I have two questions. First thing is, we're saying that God is in, or in the first, in the easy way out is to say that God is in the world and also above it.
Right.
But you can't say that God is part of the world and part above it, because you can't leave a part to God. So you're saying somehow all of God is in the world and all of God is also out of the world.
No, I don't have to say either of those. What I can say is that God fills the world and his essence, so to speak, what he is essentially, stands outside.
But the same thing that's outside of it is also in the world.
Or well, of course. But I don't have to divide it into parts. Okay, look, I'll say a little bit more. Guys are very, very aggressive. It's all right. Okay. We spoke about this, but it's hard for you to put everything together. The highest category that we have to think about when we think about God is what?
Action.
We don't think about what he is. That's beyond all describing. We think about what he does. And I did say a couple of times, the highest element in an action, the leading element in an action, the most characteristic element in action is the, think of the end of the alphabet, the will, right? The will behind the action. If you talk about an action, let's take a human action. So what do you see? The person waving his arms? Flapping his arms? Okay, he is flapping his arms. But if you don't know why he's flapping his arms, you're not describing it as a human action. You're describing it as a motion of bones and flesh. You know, well, bats move their bones and flesh also. To describe an action fully, you must include in it the description of the will that the action is carrying out. Now, this much we get of God. We get the things that he does and the will that they express. Now we say, everything in the creation is an expression of his will. That's what we mean when we say he fills the creation. There's no place empty of him, because everything that exists is an expression of his will. His will is propping everything up, detail by detail, dot by dot. Each beat of the wing of the mosquito, up, down, 1,000 times a second, or however many times it beats its wings. Each one is due to God's will, moment by moment. So, there's no place where he's missing. Now, so don't think of him as a substance, you know, oozing like an amoeba into this realm, into that realm. He's half in there, two quarters, three quarters there, one quarter here. That's not the right model. The model is a being whose will and action are accessible to us, accessible because he makes them accessible, and whose will fills the universe in the sense that everything that exists does so because of the activity of his will. Okay? Now you're having trouble with his half here and half there and all that kind of stuff. Okay. Are we...
Anything different to say that basically he's outside of time and his will creates everything, and he doesn't have to go in and monitor and have to be on hand to see that somebody raises their left hand. He can create this whole scenario automatically where it's going to happen according to his will. Yeah, and therefore he can have been operate completely outside of time.
Yeah, it's a very important question. I mentioned, maybe it was before you came, Ramchal actually asked this question in an essay that's not been translated into English, the Ma'amar al-Chachma. He says, God certainly could have created the world once, set it up like a machine, and let it run. He could have given independent existence to two things. And the apple tree grows its leaves and sprouts its apples and, you know, from year to year does it all by itself. Because he created it in such a way that it could function by itself. There's no contradiction in that. And there's no limits on God's power. He could certainly do that. He chose not to do it. He chose not to do it. What he chose to do is have his will active continuously so that there's no pre-programming, no need for pre-programming. His will continuously is making the world run. Now, this idea that his will does that is common. In the Siddur, every morning, right after the Baruch Hu, you say it twice. But Rav Chal is the only person who I know, I've ever seen, who asks why. Why did he do it that way? Since he very well could have done it the other way, why did he do it that way? And he answers that the goal of human existence, goal of human striving, is dvekus, is attachment to God. And in order to attach to God, he's got to be available. If he creates the world, he goes on holiday, and he's nowhere found in the world, then attaching yourself to him becomes an impossibility. So since that's the goal of the whole project, that's why he does it. And by the way, just a little footnote, so I mention. Again, he says he certainly could have made things to be independent because there's no limit on his power. He chose not to. Because there's no limit on his power, he says. He just chose not to. On the very next page, he says, God certainly is the only necessarily existing thing because the idea that God will make another necessarily existing thing is impossible. It's impossible. That's what he says. The very next page, the previous page, he says no limits to his power. And the next page, he says he didn't do this because it's not possible. What do you mean not possible? The previous page said everything. He can do anything. It's the answer to what I told you at least 17 times, right? That if you're going to contradict yourself in describing something, it's not a candidate to be done. Now, for A to make B, and for B to be a necessary existent thing, it's a contradiction. B is only there because A made it. So there he says, not possible, it means it's a contradiction. It's a contradiction that we're not describing anything. On the previous page, he's talking about something which is not a contradiction. The question is, does he have enough power? Of course he has enough power. There's a limit to his power. If it's a question of how much power, no limits. If it's a question of a contradiction, then we are at fault for not describing it correctly. I was so happy when I found that about a year ago because I've been saying it on my own as a piece of logic, but I'd say it's about 90% explicit there that's what's going on. Okay, we got the time. Yeah.
Just got a difficulty with what you mentioned about a tree, say, only being alive because God is constantly willing it to be. So when someone cuts it down, is that in effect changing God's will or?
No, it's much deeper than that. The existence of everything is dependent upon God's continuous will. Its very existence. Now, of course, its state changes from moment to moment. It gets older, the leaves grow down, the leaves grow, the water transpires up through the... Well, just to remember that stuff is... I can't remember my botany from 45 years ago. Of course, the characteristics of things change, their state changes, but moment by moment, their existence and the various states that they have moment by moment is given because God continues to make them exist. Yeah, Papal Ziyoter? Okay. That's chapter 3. Now, you see that beginning of chapter 4, I already told you verbally. So I'm up to chapter 4, paragraph 4, page 65. Here he says something very important. I mean, I keep saying that over and over again because it's all very important. It strikes me every time I think I have to read it. So up until now, how do we look at the physical? The body, the physical world. The enemy. Right? The enemy, it's there that God is hiding. It's there that we can lose sight of God. We can be taken in by the illusion. It's there that we can come to the false idea, maybe in that forbidden thing there's some good, although God told me not to take it. The enemy is the great, the physical is the great enemy. Now, Ramchal says, it was from the depths of his wisdom, God's wisdom, blessed be his name, to organize things in such a way that even though a person is necessarily submerged in the physical, as we have written, he'll be able, from amidst, in the middle of the material itself, and through his interaction, involvement in the bodily, to achieve perfection. And therefore, his descent, his being pushed down, will be his elevation. Being pushed into this physical world, submerged in this material world, which is a terrible descent, that will be itself his elevation. From there, from his position of being submerged in the world, he will acquire his grandeur and his honor that is incomparable to anything else, when he transforms the darkness to light and the shadow of death to shining brightness, sparkling blue. Put away your Shakespeare. Now, let me say this sort of philosophically, and then I'll apply it in detail to what he's talking about here, but I'd like you to have kind of general schema for what's going on. We said over and over again, man has to have free will. Why? Because he has to be similar to God, and similarity means it's got to be self-determined. That's how a creature can be self-determined, through free will. So, we could say it works in two stages, or there's two fundamental principles. First of all, free will, and whatever is necessary for free will. Well, one thing that's necessary, as we said, is that God should hide. If God's presence is open, visible, it's overwhelming. And to go against his will is just impossible. So, he hides, and in that way we have free will. Okay, now that we have free will, what should we do? Well, we should do something, you know, something, do something. And as you do this thing, whatever it is, you will be creating for yourself this accomplishment, this achievement, and then you'll be self-determined in that achievement. What should the achievement be? I don't know, jumping through hoops or weaving baskets, or I don't know, just do something. Do it because God said so, you know. If you did it that way, you'd have a system with two axioms. Number one, free will and God's hiding so you can do anything at all. And number two, what it is you have to do. But philosophically, you'd like to be as economical as possible. Why have a system based on two axioms if you could create a system based on one axiom? Maybe we could all collapse it all into one idea. And that's what he does. He says it more explicitly elsewhere. He's just taking the application. What he says is this. You have to be able to act on your own so you can be self-determined. So God has to hide. And then, it is God's hiding that becomes the subject of the activity. It's not basket weaving, and it's not jumping through hoops. It is the conditions of having free will that become the very subject of your free will. The very activity of your free will. It's not something else. It's all built into the same axiom. And here's how it works. God's hiding makes free will possible. And the project of free will is to undo God's hiding. God's hiding makes free will possible. And the project of free will is to undo God's hiding. It's to pull away the layers of concealment and reveal God. So there's really only one fundamental reality. The fundamental reality is God's hiddenness. that becomes the condition under which we can act, and it becomes the focus of the activity. The focus of the activity is to undo God's hiddenness. Now, here he says that man is submerged in the physical. We said, why is the physical inherently evil? What was the inherent evil in the physical? That it hides God's presence. That enables a person to miss God. That it sucks a person into a position of thinking that something that's not God could have independent reality, independent importance, independent value. The theme of the physical is, I'm real and I stand alone. Which is a big lie. Nothing stands alone. Everything's created by God. But the theme of the physical is to present this false appearance that stands alone. And to suck the person into that false appearance. So you say, well, that's terrible, you know? I mean, my gosh. The physical is the thing that's blinding me to God's presence. So he says, and then you think, well, then the physical is the enemy. And now, where would you go with this? You'd probably go to India, see? Because if the physical is what's blinding you, turn your back on the physical. Don't eat. Live in a cave, you know, where you can't see things. Turn off the physical so that you can find God and not be subject to the illusion. So he says, no. The Jewish position is exact opposite of that. The Jewish position is that by involving yourself in the physical and acting within the physical and interacting with the physical, that in itself will be the way to reveal God's presence. You reveal God's presence in the hiddenness. Not by turning your back on the hiddenness, by plunging yourself head first into the hiddenness and transforming it. Thereby saying, that's why he says, man's very descent is his elevation. It's because he descends into the material, which hides God's presence, and then is given a plan, a strategy, a set of rules, which are called mitzvot. Surprise, surprise. Right? That these mitzvot enable us to reveal God's presence in this physical, thereby, he says, transforming the physical. Thereby, biyoso hofeich es hachoshech laor. He transforms the darkness into light. He transforms the darkness into light. Not that he turns his back on the darkness and seeks the light elsewhere. No, he plunges himself into the darkness and transforms it into light. Transforming the shadow of death into shining brilliance. So it's his being plunged into the physical that gives him the capacity to achieve his greatest perfection. I want to add one more point of explanation, then I'll take your questions. I think I mentioned this briefly. I didn't stress it, but this paragraph. The point of the creation is chesed, loving kindness. That's God's loving kindness. He did it to express loving kindness. So, he created us to make us as godlike as possible, which thereby means he's doing the greatest possible good. Okay, we have to be godlike. So, if his main activity, so to speak, or his goal of all his activity is chesed, loving kindness, we too have to have that as our theme. Doing loving kindness. If we do loving kindness, we will be as godlike as a creature can be. If we're doing something else, you know, then we're not doing what God is doing. If you think that there's a creator, and you think that your spiritual perfection means turning your back on the world, then what you're saying is, your spiritual perfection means being unlike the creator. I think intellectually that's problematic. And there are religions like that. Why wouldn't your greatest perfection be to be similar to the Creator. The Creator didn't turn his back on the perfect, on the creation. The Creator is not sitting and meditating on himself. He's creating the world. Why is he doing that? How could it be that he's creating seahorses and starfish and mosquitoes and you have to go off to a cave someplace to avoid all that? He's doing one thing, you're doing the opposite? Why would that be your greatest perfection? It's a little funny intellectually. That's certainly not our picture is to be as similar to God as possible. And he's creating this whole shebang. Okay, now he's doing to do the greatest good. The greatest good means you deliver goodness to something. He's delivering goodness to us. We're supposed to be doing chesed, loving kindness. Who is receiving it from us? Who's receiving it from us? He's doing his chesed by giving it to us. The chesed he's giving to us is making us like him. Making us like him means that we should be doing chesed. So to whom are we doing chesed? Now in this paragraph, what we're being told is, we are doing chesed to the whole of the physical world. Because the whole of the physical world is created with a potential. A potential for a certain condition, a condition it doesn't have by itself. But we can give it that condition. All it has is a potential. It is created in such a way that it hides God's presence. Through our activity, we can make it reveal God's presence. When it reveals God's presence, it becomes perfect for its station. You know, you can use the word perfect as a relative term. That is perfect apple pie. Well, that's a perfect, you know, Parker pens, I think, are pretty close to perfect. they're cheap, which is another great smile that they have. Right? Or that's a perfect digital camera. You know, things are perfect on their level. Now, the perfection of the physical world is to reflect God's presence, to show God's presence. It's created in such a way that it hides it. We can't, this was the shell that was opaque, it becomes transparent, it becomes an ally of the light. You see, it's all the same thing over and over again, just different words, different term, points of view, but it's all the same thing. I hold that to be a virtue. I mean, it might be, get boring, but I hold it to be a virtue because you don't need new ideas all the time. So, this is why. He says, man can, from the midst of the material itself, and his involvement in the bodily, achieve his, man's, greatest perfection, and his elevation to his greatest purity. And on the contrary, his descent causes or is his elevation, and from there, in his descent into the material, he will acquire his glory and his honor, that's unparalleled, when in his transforming the darkness into light. Now why does that give him his perfection? When he transforms the darkness into light. Because he is then giving shleimus, giving perfection to the physical world. He's making it perfect. And that's what chesed is. Chesed means giving good. Here's a thing, a table, a lump of dirt, a squirrel. Here's a thing which, as it stands, doesn't show God's presence, and can be made to show God's presence. That perfects it. And man can do that. When he does that, he's being godlike. Then you understand the meaning of stories like you have in the Talmud, other places where the calf runs to the slaughterer and, you know, to be slaughtered by this man because he's very holy. Or the stones under Jacob's, when Jacob lies down for the dream, and each stone says, let this try to put its head on me. Right? Because when the physical world serves the spiritual, it then reveals God's will in the world. It becomes transformed from darkness into light, and it achieves its perfection. So through its service of man who's serving God, it too achieves its perfection. We grant perfection, we cause perfection in the physical world. And that's the way we are bestowing good on something outside of ourselves, just as God bestows good on us. That's part of the dynamics of what's going on. Okay, question. You had a question a while ago.
Uh, You said God kind of hides when it's us have free will, but isn't there anything we do also the will of God?
It is the will of God that we should exercise free will. It's also the will of God that with our free will we should choose particular things. Now, if when God wills that we should choose particular things, he's going to allow his will to cause us to act, then he doesn't get what he wants. Because what he wants is for us to will certain things. That's something he can't get by making it happen. Because that's a contradiction. If he makes it happen, then we're not willing it. So, what he has to do is give us free will, command us, and then, when we follow his command, his will is being enacted in the world. But if it's his will that we should will these things, he can't bring it about by forcing it. Then he's not getting what he wants. There's certain things which even an all-powerful being may want and can't provide for himself by his own power. If what he wants is that the thing should happen independently. And he can't bring it about that it should happen independently. Because that's a contradiction.
That's cool.
Yeah, isn't it? I appreciate the nice thought, yeah.
I don't know if this means to sound like it, but it still sounds like we have two stages here. Because we say on one hand that man has to have free will, which is provided by God's hiding, and the project of his will is to reveal God. But in addition, his actions, and in that sense, him using his free will to reveal God, is because he's using his free will, and therefore he's like God. But in addition to that, he also acts like God in doing kindness, which is in and of itself acting like God, but then on the other hand, that same action of doing kindness also reveals God.
Where is the kindness here? The kindness here is, kindness means doing good. That's what kindness means. Now, where's the good that's getting done? The good that's getting done is that this table, which at present is hiding God's presence, will be transformed into something that reveals God's presence. That makes the table perfect. That realizes the spiritual potential of the table. So my doing good is perfecting the table. And I perfect the table by making it a vehicle for revealing God's presence. All comes out to be one thing. Yeah.
So how do then Gentiles fit into this whole scenario about it being perfected?
Gentiles have their own mitzvos, about 65 of them. And when they perform mitzvos, they perfect their own spirituality. And they affect their own material existence. So they're playing the same role, only on a reduced level.
65?
Yeah, I know they talk about the seven Noahide laws. It's really seven categories of Noahide laws.
Oh.
There are good books written for Noahides, several books in English. And if you look at them, we have at least one in the library upstairs, which goes through a list of all of them.
So if you talk about the idea that only the way that we can really have free will is if God is hidden, right? So if that's the case, so in instances in our history where God made himself very obvious, like by Matanzara and such, and then right away people sinned, even though God was right there and he wasn't hiding, is that more of a strengthening of the idea of free will, that you see that people, even though they saw God right out in front of them, they still were able to do bad, so we must have the idea of free will.
There's no question, what you're saying is 100% right, and it goes much further, actually. There's no question, the more God reveals himself, the less free will you have. And the more he hides, the more free will you have. And in a sense, God has to strike a balance at any moment in time, and a balance historically, so as to support the level of free will and the quality of free will that he wants at any particular time. Obviously, if he hides so well that nobody finds him, then there's no free will to do good, because you don't know he's there. On the other hand, if he's open, manifest, palpable, continuously, so then no free will on the evil side. And indeed, commentators say that at Sinai, and only at Sinai, but the ensuing 40 years, where they were fed miraculously with manna from heaven, and they had the pillar of cloud in the daytime, the pillar of fire at nighttime, the clouds of glory, which maintain a constant temperature and humidity and filtered out the UVF rays and they flattened the terrain, you know, that they lost a very great measure of their free will. And their lives did not have the significance, that the range of significance that a normal human life should have. The Rav Shekhovah says this, the man from this yeshiva's name. So, however, it shouldn't be exaggerated. When you're in the midst of an experience of prophecy, then you do become a robot. The minute that experience passes, there is a restoration of free will. To some extent, some free will. It's quite obvious that there, in the wilderness, no one had the free will to be an atheist. That would be like disbelieving in tables. You know, it's right in front of you. Well, you're atheist. Don't be. You couldn't even imagine such an idea. So the range of free will was greatly reduced. Your point in general is correct, and I think. I just make one last remark, then I got to quit. Some people ask why we don't have open miracles today. The answer is that the psychological impact of a miracle depends upon your environment and your expectations. In the ancient world, all the gods did miracles. All of them. Every lightning bolt was Jupiter. And so you'll tell the Greeks, you know something? 1,000 years ago, our god split the sea. He says, well, what's he been doing lately? Our god's throwing bolts. Every time there's a storm, he's active. You can see it yourself. That's a great deal, because once upon a time, he split the sea. You know, give me a break. I got lots of much better things to share. And this god's blowing, make the wind blow, and that god's making the births take place, you know, god of fertility. And the gods are all around you, and they're doing miracles all the time. So in that context, if God is a miracle for us, it's not going to overwhelm a person. It's just, joining the club. Very nice. Today, if you'd have a pillar of fire, you know, floating down Fifth Avenue, that would really be very spectacular. I think you'd have people in the shuls, people keeping kosher, giving Shabbos right away. We wouldn't get any questions anymore. Okay.